You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Russia, Turkey, Saudi Arabia and the United States get together in Vienna to try to sort out Syria. How hard can it be? My guests Nina Schick and Michael Binion will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including as Germany continues to push for mandatory quotas to disperse migrants across the EU, Slovenia becomes the latest member state to consider fencing its border. In not unrelated news, one of the countries least affected by immigration prepares to vote in an election dominated by xenophobia. The polls go to the polls. And as Britain's red carpet hire shops mourn the departure of President Xi Jinping of China, we'll ask why the UK seemed so determined to act so far above and beyond the call of diplomatic courtesy. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Nina Schick, Director of Communications at Open Europe, and Michael Binion, a longtime foreign correspondent currently with The Times here in London. Welcome both. We are going to start tonight with today's diplomatic conclave in Vienna, at which the foreign ministers of the United States, Saudi Arabia, Russia and Turkey have gathered to address matters of common concern, specifically Syria. These being four states which regard each other with suspicion at best, outright hostility at worst, it would seem optimistic to expect the fruits of their deliberations to be usefully ripe. Michael, first of all, do they actually have common interests in Syria? Do they all want the same thing, basically?
They don't all want the same thing, but they do all want something to happen that stops the terrible round of fighting and the massive exodus of refugees. They also are all equally terrified of Islamic State, which is operating in Syria and Iraq, and have sort of pooled strategies for how to deal with that.
Nina, this is something we've talked about before, and it's my own cockeyed attempt to try and look upon the Syrian shambles with any sort of optimism. Is there, in the fact that, as Michael points out, there are two obvious common interests, one in the rise of Islamic State, one in the waves of immigration, largely prompted by the rise of Islamic State, can countries like Russia and the United States actually end up working together?
Well, I think that's what we're seeing right now, and they have no choice in that matter. They have to work together. And the fact that Russia has wrapped this up in the language of, you know, what seems appealing to the West, we're in there to defeat terrorists, we're there to fight IS, obviously they have their own strategic interests to guard as well. But that means that the West has to come to the negotiating table with Russia. Russia has to be included. Of course, they were frozen out of international talks for a long time following Ukraine. So it is a tactical intervention on Russia's part. And I would say so far they have the upper hand.
Following that point of Nina's up, Michael, how much is that motivating Russia's intervention in Syria? Obviously, they do have obvious strategic interests there. They're a longtime ally. They have military bases, etc., etc. But as Nina points out, their adventure in Ukraine saw them rather consigned to the outer. Have they now completely recaptured the initiative?
I wouldn't say completely, but they've recaptured a great deal of it, and I think it's a very smart move. Yes, they also calculate, quite rightly, that Washington and other Western capitals can only really deal with one crisis at a time, and the spotlight is rather off Ukraine at the moment. And Russia is now putting itself forward as this flexible negotiator, ready to take the initiative, even summoning Assad to Moscow, and quietly whispering to the West that they were there talking to him about possible new negotiations with the opposition, something of that kind, and suggesting to the West that opposition to any attempt at a negotiated settlement is hopeless and foolish, and there is no military victory, which is exactly really what the conclusion that the Americans and others have come to.
John Kerry, of course, Nina, is still insisting, or at least repeating America's line that Assad must go, though nobody seems to be too clear on in favour of what and or whom. It was understandable, I guess, in the early days of the crisis, why people insisted that Assad should go. But have America and its allies rather dug themselves into a, you can't dig yourself into a corner or paint yourself into a hole. Have they done one of those two things there? Have they left themselves with no room for manoeuvre where Assad's concerned?
I think America, there's certainly room for manoeuvre. I think perhaps in the case of Europe, a little bit less so, also because of the migrant crisis and because they have to work very closely with Turkey. Michael and I were just chatting about this outside, and Erdogan has been, you know, he's been very strong that Assad has to go. So I think Europe will have to consider Turkey a little bit more. But I think in the long term, I don't think the Russians necessarily want Assad to stay either. They just want to secure a regime. They want to have some kind of political agreement. And I think quietly after that, we might see Assad retiring
to Moscow. But Michael, as Russia sort of continues to act to protect and indeed shore up their man in Damascus, how much and it's long since past the point at which it was very difficult to look at ways forward in Syria without descending into cynicism at some level. But how much advantage militarily might Russia have over other involved countries in that Russia, from a PR point of view, are possibly a little bit less squeamish about what they're seen to bomb?
Absolutely, yes. The Russians have no qualms about that at all. And in fact, sending in missiles in the first wave appears to have turned the tide straight away for Assad and has allowed him to start taking the initiative again in Aleppo and in the northern regions where he was losing to the opposition. The Americans really are rather squeamish about what they bomb. First of all, they don't really know who to bomb or what, apart from ISIS, which is clearly what all the Europeans are agreed on. But when it comes to the various rebel groups, how do you consider some of them? How do you consider Jabhat al-Nusra, which is affiliated to al-Qaeda? Are they friend or foe? It's not really clear. The Russians have an absolutely clear agenda, and to some extent it's a very logical one, which is in the end, it has to be a negotiated solution. You cannot expect a government to negotiate when it's losing. If Assad is winning, he may come to the table. Then we'll try and do a deal. But first of all, we've got to make sure that he's either on top or has won. Some side has got to win. If you just push him out, you'll get an absolute motley crew and probably Islamists in power in Damascus. Do you want that? Well, it's a clever argument, and the Russians are as smart and as far-sighted as they are purely opportunistic, which is a combination of both.
Final thought on this, Nina. Is it possible that the rest of the world, other than Russia, which has been stridently anti-Assad for the last 4 years, and not without reason, he has behaved absolutely abominably, but might they be just coming round to the realistic realization that what has to happen in Syria is that somebody needs to win the war? And if it's most likely to be Assad with Russian support, that might be, as is so often the case in politics, the least worst available option.
Absolutely. And I, of course, like, this is very, very strong, especially in Europe, because you are seeing the effects of what's happening in Syria, and it's affecting people directly through the migrant crisis. And of course, as Europe is struggling to try find a solution to this, countries like America, Australia, so on, also come under pressure because they're not seen to be doing enough. So I think if they can find a way to broker some kind of political solution, leaders will privately be grasping for that opportunity.
Okay, well, we'll move along now, because elsewhere in Europe, away from Vienna at least, Slovenia has become the latest focus of the ongoing migration crisis. And not coincidentally, Slovenia has also become the latest European country to consider fortifying its border. Since Hungary sealed its border with Croatia last weekend, the columns of migrants and or refugees have begun turning up in Slovenia, at least 50,000 people since Saturday. Another meeting of EU leaders is due on Sunday in Brussels. Germany continues to push for compulsory permanent quotas for member states. Michael, we've seen this happen over the last few weeks, fences going up, perhaps ironically, around the countries which 25 years ago rejoiced in fences coming down. The thing is, of course, that requires a kind of irresistible momentum, doesn't it? When you put fences up, one country puts fences up and diverts refugee flows into another country, which then feels obliged to do that. Are we now looking at, I guess, an irreversible path towards the EU fortifying its borders?
I think we are, and I think we're looking at more than that. I think we're looking at probably the beginning of the end of the Schengen Agreement of border-free Europe, because Germany itself has started border controls with Austria and various other countries, temporary, of course, as they say, but once you put border controls back in place, and once other countries invoke the idea that national emergencies overrule this border-free regime, then you start getting these these things more permanent, and then people feel, well, it's the only way to secure our security, secure the number of people coming in and out of our countries.
What would be the practical upshot, Nina, if the EU was effectively walled off along its border with the East?
I mean, even though someone like Orban is not popular at all, and he hasn't evoked much sympathy by putting up those border, erecting that massive fence at Hungary's borders, he's doing what the EU says they have to do. He's protecting the EU's external border. So you can understand why a country like Hungary or Slovenia is only a country of 2 million, is just absolutely overwhelmed. Unless the EU's external border is protected, there simply is no other solution. So it's interesting, actually, today, new news has been leaking out of Berlin that the new kind of initiative that Merkel wants to undertake is to actually take refugees from camps in Turkey and in Syria and then bring them to Europe and then distribute them around Europe. Now, this might inject a little bit more control into this entire crisis, because right now it's just thousands of people arriving at the borders and people just don't know how to react. You start having a little bit more of a honest conversation with the public, saying, look, if you're going to be part of the developed nations, like, this is part of the responsibility. And then you can at least start setting up integration systems. You can actually have places to house these refugees and have a system in place to separate illegal economic migrants from refugees who are actually in need. So it'll be interesting to see. This is the idea that Merkel is going to push at that summit on Sunday. It'll be interesting to see how much pushback there is, because there inevitably will be from the Eastern and Central European countries. But it will also hopefully start to break the link between the people who are profiting off of this massively, the illegal people smugglers, by no longer making that journey viable by taking people from camps directly. That might be the first step towards dealing with what is an incredibly difficult and complex problem.
I mean, it can well be imagined that among those in the forefront of that pushback will be the rather charmless Mr. Orban. He has accused Merkel of what he is pleased to describe as moral imperialism, Michael, in her plan for mandatory refugee quotas. Is that phrase likely to stick elsewhere in Eastern Europe especially?
No, and I think it's a bit rich coming from a country which only 50 years ago saw a massive exodus of refugees in the face of Russian tanks, willingly taken across the border into Austria and then distributed all around Europe, including Britain at the time.
We have learnt from this crisis that memories are rather short.
They are indeed, yes, and so are political statements. I mean, they can be turned upside down in a few weeks.
Nina, though, you've outlined Merkel's plan there, and she has mentioned this before. Is there any chance, do you think, of everybody else signing up to it, particularly looking at this from the point of view of Britain, of course, whose government claims it wants to keep the country in the EU ahead of the referendum due at some point in the next couple of years. But the political reality is that, I guess, the increase of immigration is mandated by the EU is not going to make the EU more popular in Britain, is it?
No, it's certainly not. But this is something that people who are campaigning to get Britain out of the EU, it's an opportunity for them to conflate issues. Because, of course, the refugee crisis has nothing to do with free movement of people within the EU, which is the issue that they say, unless we leave the EU, we're not going to, the refugees aren't arriving at Britain's borders. And in fact, by Britain being in the EU, they have the best of both worlds, because they have an opt-out out of asylum policy, so they don't have to take any under this quota system. They're not part of the Schengen zone, so they're not in the border-free travel area. And also, their border is effectively in France. So when we see migrants gathering in Calais, the British government is getting a lot of help from the French to not allow them to come into the UK. So this is a complex issue which has obviously played into the hands of those who want to take Britain out. But I just want to go back to a point that Michael made about Merkel. And even though Orban is out there on the right and he accused Merkel of imperialism, but that is the feeling, actually. This is the feeling that is felt in the Central and Eastern European countries. The people in the Commission say they've never seen so much animosity in recent history, not even at the heights of the Eurozone crisis, as there has been over the migrant crisis. So it's because the issue of immigration is something that's very of course, it's very sensitive. And when the Commission decided to take a vote using QMV to enforce those mandatory quotas, they're dealing with the fallout now. It's Merkel is not loved amongst many European leaders.
Well, Eastern
right
European countries have never had waves of immigration. I mean, in the communist times, they didn't have people coming in and seeking to go and live there. Western Europe's been used to this for quite a long time. Britain, France, Germany itself, others, they've had people coming from far away, the Caribbean, from India, Pakistan, Turkey, wherever. And we are quite used to the idea, or more used to the idea, of a multicultural society. Homogeneous countries such as Slovenia or Hungary itself or various others are completely unused to dealing with people who are not part of their ethnic heritage.
And I guess especially it doesn't help when your first exposure to those people appears on your border in such a disorganized, unruly and desperate fashion.
Absolutely. It's not the best impression you get of people who are meant to be the one day trying to integrate as model Hungarian citizens.
Nina, just a final thought on this. I guess I'm trying to ask, why is it that it seems impossible for politicians and media in the EU to discuss this in anything other than binary terms? There's this conflation of refugees and migrants, or actually there isn't a conflation. They have to be either one or the other. We saw them first regarded as a to borrow the language of David Cameron, a swarm of marauding migrants. Then after the publication of one ghastly photo, everybody was terribly sympathetic, a wave that seems to have subsided. But there appears to be a reluctance to recognise that many of these people are desperate refugees in genuine need, and many of them are opportunists and chancers. Why is it that difficult to accept that this is obviously the case?
I think because it seems so uncontrolled, and I mean it because it seems to have just arisen over summer, the immediate reaction is panic. And then when people realize, like you said, that awful photo of that young child drowned, then the immediate impulse then is of course sympathy. I think the only way to tackle that is to get some control back into this, and the first steps to do that is you need to have a conversation with the transit and origin countries, notably Turkey, which of course Merkel is trying to broker. You need to actually beef up the EU's external borders. It's essential. You can't leave frontline countries, especially small countries, just struggling with thousands of people, which it obviously is not capable of handling. And then you need to have an honest debate with the public about the responsibilities of bringing real refugees in, and then having some controlled system where they can settle into society and integrate. For example, in Germany now, they're creating a channel just for refugees to it's called Refugee TV, basically, to help them integrate into society.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Mullett, Nina Schick and Michael Binion. Coming up next, we'll look ahead to Poland's election and we'll look back on Xi Jinping's visit to Britain.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, the Monocle Travel Guides. And the series kicks off with London and with New York City. New York used to be such an easy city to crack for the visitor, but now its focus has fractured and shifted. Why not let Monocle help you to navigate it?
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Monocle has had a bureau in New York since its launch in 2007. And our travel guide is a celebration of all that we know and love about this place. We put together a list of the finest places and experiences the Big Apple has to offer. Be it a cozy stay at the Cosby Street Hotel, a late drink in a classic bar like King Cole in Midtown, or a top-notch fuss-free trim at Cheese in Brooklyn. Let us take you beyond the obvious to reveal the hidden spots New York has to offer. Published by Gestalten, these books are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists. So pick up the Monocle Travel Guide to New York in Monocle shops, at monocle.com, and in all good bookstores. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Nina Schick and Michael Binion. Now, the short-term effects of the migration crisis on the politics of EU members may become clear this weekend as Poland votes in a general election. Though Poland has taken in relatively few migrants and or refugees, xenophobic paranoia has nonetheless proved a depressingly profitable electoral tack. The right-wing Law and Justice Party look on course to match their success in May's presidential vote. Nina, it does seem to be a thing that this sort of rhetoric sells best where there are actually almost no immigrants. I mean, it's something we've seen in Britain when people have like looked at where UKIP polls very well. It tends to be places where there aren't actually any foreigners.
Yeah, and I think, like I said, the recent tussle at the EU level about these mandatory binding quotas to resettle refugees around Europe really gave this party a boost. And it's interesting because this is a kind of anti-immigration and Eurosceptic party, and we're seeing the rise of these parties across Europe, you know, not just in Poland. In Sweden, a country that we think of as being very liberal and, you know, integrating lots of different cultures very well, you have the Sweden Democrats who are really anti-immigrant, polling at 25% right now, and the government is potentially going to collapse. So I think the big point is that you have to engage with these issues. I know they're contentious. I know it's difficult to talk about immigration, but the government needs to have an honest debate with the population about it. Otherwise, people just end up striving, going to the right.
On the subject of those populist parties, and there are exceptions to the rule I invented about half an hour ago, like Sweden, which you mentioned, and Denmark. But Michael, it strikes me that the populist sort of the angry populist parties in the former Western Bloc tend to be left-wing, whereas the angry populist parties in the former communist world tend to be right-wing.
Yes, well, there are various elements that add on. In the former communist world, you've got the added bonus of nationalism, which they're allowed to express at last after 40 years of Russian repression, you know, Russia sitting on top of them, as it were, not allowing them to express national feeling. And that tends to be an element that goes to the right. You've also got religion. You've got, in the Polish example, a very strong Catholic Church, which tends to pull to the right on issues such as abortion or anything to do with sexual morality or whatever it might be, traditional values, which tend to lump people in with the right as well. I wouldn't also say that it's only on the left you get populist discontent in the West. Yes, at the moment, Britain has got a curious, quirky kind of insurgent leftist uprising in the form of the New Labour Party in Britain. But mostly right-wing protest is pretty common in the West as well.
Nina, the tone of this election in Poland has been sort of curiously fretful and paranoid, especially for a country which is measured against most of Europe, and not just most of Eastern Europe, but most of Europe, actually doing really quite well. Why the anxiety and discontent?
Well, I think the former government, which has been in power for 8 years now, there's just been kind of a decline. And ever since Tusk, he left to become European Council President, this is the former Polish PM, Ewa Kopacz, who took over, didn't manage to revitalize her party. And there's generally just a feeling of anxiety across the EU, where you see the rise of these kind of anti-establishment, anti-EU parties. And that's certainly the case with Law and Justice in Poland. Interestingly, one of the biggest issues in this election campaign was that of the euro. So, like you said, Poland has been doing relatively well under the tenure of Civic Platform. Its GDP grew by a third. You know, it's economically doing well. It's not involved in the eurozone crisis. But it is legally bound still to join the euro according to the treaties. And that was a massive, massive problem in this election campaign. So the interesting point is, no matter what happens, no matter who wins, Poland won't join the euro. It's been 10 years about away from joining the euro for about 10 years. And that puts it in an interesting position. Like, how will it integrate with the rest of Europe? I think the wider point is this feeling across Europe that we also see in Poland of anti-establishment parties, people being fretful about their future, and that being exacerbated by things like the migrant crisis.
Just finally on this subject, Michael, you mentioned there earlier the resurgence in nationalism in Eastern Europe after decades of domination by Moscow. In Poland, to what extent does its... I mean, it has had terrible luck with the neighbours over the centuries. to what extent does that fear at one level or another of either Germany and or Russia still define Polish politics?
Oh, it's absolutely basic to all Polish conceptions of their own nation. The fear of Russia is possibly not quite such an immediate one now, because Poland feels protected behind NATO or within NATO. And not surprisingly, Poland is one of the most hawkish nations in NATO over what's been happening in Ukraine and over relations with Russia, hawkish militarily and also economically. They are are equally worried about Germany, always have been, and in fact one of the accusations against Civic Platform is that it's in Merkel's pocket, that it is just the lapdog of German interests. So they are equally worried about both their neighbours and always have been, and that gives them a very strong sense of Poland being a nation that has to stick together because its own identity is and has been threatened so often.
Okay, well, finally tonight, now or now about, Chinese President Xi Jinping is flying out of Manchester at the end of his first state visit to the UK. Following yesterday's excitements, which included fish and chips and a pint at the local hostelry of Prime Minister David Cameron, President Xi has today visited the National Graphene Institute, whatever that is, and the home ground of Manchester City, although he apparently inclines personally towards United. And as has been the case all week, President Xi has been treated with courtesy, which could be very easily mistaken for outright obsequiousness. Nina, has the UK overdone it, do we think?
It was quite a fawning display, almost a bit awkward to watch when the state banquet was being, the banquet in Buckingham Palace was being live streamed. But, I mean, even though we can be critical of the government about overdoing it, quote unquote, China is an important person to have on board. It's an important ally to have. And even though their human rights record and many other things are very questionable, I'm half Tibetan, I should know. you need to have them at the table, and because they're such a big power. You know, if the West needs to have some kind of rapprochement with them, they need to work together, and hopefully exert influence through the soft diplomatic means.
Well, this is an argument that has been floated, that that if you actually do business with people, then that gives you more leverage vis-a-vis human rights, etc., than just ignoring them or freezing them out. Michael, are you buying that, or is that somewhat self-serving?
No, I do buy that. I buy it very much in places like China or Japan, even, where face is all important, and where megaphone diplomacy, in other words, trumpeting your objections to their way of treating their own citizens, absolutely is counterproductive, simply doesn't work. I don't quite know how much influence even quiet diplomacy has, because China is so big, it doesn't really need to take any notice of any of all this. On the other hand, they do worry about their public image. Other countries also worry about it to some extent. Saudi Arabia is a very tricky example, because they have an equally disastrous human rights record, and Britain has finally actually stood up and said, well, we're not going along with some of these measures that we've agreed to do jointly with Saudi Arabia because we don't like your human rights record. And now that's quite unusual. But with China, I don't think the fawning has been so objectionable. What, of course, they get is the special crested Buckingham Palace chocolate put on the pillow at night or something like that, which he's probably looking at on the way home in the plane thinking, wasn't that great? Now, that's fine. You can lay on the Queen, and the Queen goes down pretty well almost everywhere. But actually, Britain didn't really... They didn't say anything that seemed to be really outrageously kind of kowtowing, and they did quietly voice hopes that Hong Kong would be treated fairly or that various other issues could be looked at, where the message is coded, but the message is there.
Do you think that the UK especially in the last few weeks, Nina, has made much play of its hopes for a relationship with China? Which country do you think has more to gain from it?
The UK.
And that could be the answer to all the other questions right there.
Exactly.
It is strange, though. Do you think the visit has actually accomplished anything concrete?
Well, they signed a few deals, obviously. And I think, like Michael was saying, face matters so much. And a lot of this was live streamed back in China as well. So the population in China will have taken notice if they were tuning in. But I also think it's interesting that that Britain has done this, has taken upon itself to do this by alone and not try to do something with the rest of the EU vis-a-vis China. And that might be for domestic reasons as well, with a referendum coming up. But of course, if the UK and the rest of the EU could do something together, you have much more clout. You're a much bigger market. You have many more people.
We will have to leave it there. Nina Schick and Michael Binion, thank you very much for joining us. That is all for today's edition, which was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Federica Romaniello. Our studio manager was Chris Chauvers. For the next half hour, Chris will still be here keeping you company with Monocle's International Playlist. At 1900 hours, Marcus Hippie is in with the menu. The Monocle Daily follows at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time. That's 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Have a good weekend and thanks for listening.